This is the story of Charlie Ball, a slave on the run from the lashes of his master and the fear of his gun. A mammoth of a man stood 6 foot six. His black
story of Charlie Ball, Charles Ball, an enslaved man who became a free man, and part of his story is part of the story we're going to talk about today. It's part of our Maryland story. We're here with Vince Leckett, an historian, a Morgan State grad, founder of the Blacks of Chesapeake, author of The Chesapeake Bay Through Ebony Eyes. And Vince Leckett, welcome. Good to have you in the studio, man. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mark. This is a great day. The sun is shining, the birds are flying low, and life is good on the Chesapeake.
There we go. So I'm really fascinated by what you dedicated a good part of your life to, which is unearthing the African-American story and the history of this region in Maryland and Baltimore and the Bay through, as you say, ebony eyes, through African-American eyes, through African eyes. Talk about that sojourn, how you got to this, what pushed you to do this.
Well, Charlie, Mark, I grew up in East Baltimore, about a 9-hour away from Morgan State University, down at Harford and 25th Street, and my dad was a fisherman and a hunter, and so he introduced me to the Chesapeake Bay, and I caught the spirit of the bay as a young kid. It was a great alternative to the asphalt and concrete of the city, but it was just something about the bay and the water that I was always been at peace with. As I grew older and just had an interest in the bay and the people along the bay, I began to collect stories and visit towns, and soon it crossed from a advocation to a vocation because I spent so much time. But again, if you go through colleges, universities, and public libraries and flip through books on the Chesapeake Bay, it's very seldom you see people of color. If you do, they're probably crab picking or shucking oysters.
Exactly, working in canneries or something.
Working
in
canneries, but never any names. The caption just says crab pickers or oyster shuckers. So I say, well, who are these people?
And so, so talk a bit about this issue. But let me start with the song we came in with, Charles Ball.
Yes, Charles Ball was an individual who was born in 1789 in Calvert County. That's in southern Maryland, nestled in between the Patuxent and Potomac Rivers. He was a waterman. He worked on the Chesapeake Bay fishing and crabbing. And when the British invaded the Chesapeake Bay as a run-up to the War of 1812, Charles Ball eventually joined in with the American forces and actually fought at Bladensburg and fought in Benedict and even defended Baltimore at Fort McHenry. But his basis, his trade, his avocation was a Chesapeake Bay waterman.
He was enslaved.
He was enslaved, yes.
And he became free after the war.
He became free after the war, but his story is a fascinating one, and it was chronicled in a book that he wrote in 1837 called 50 Years in Chains, The Life and Times of Charles Ball. And in this narrative, he chronicles how he was sold into bondage three times and during his lifetime served in bondage and servitude for over 50 years.
Even after the war.
This was a run-up to the war.
To the war.
But even afterwards, after the war was over, you know that the paddy rollers or the fugitive slave catchers came and got him again from Baltimore County and this time hauled him back to Georgia?
So, I mean, I think that is emblematic of a story that happened to so many people who were African-American, who were black in our nation when enslavement was happening across this country and were free, and they were always in danger of being picked up and thrown
yes.
into slavery, always.
Yes, and then you look at stories, whether it's the Harriet Tubman, and she pressed all the way to Canada because, again, the long arm of the slave enforcement reached all through the Americas. The classic Dred Scott case, even if you made it into a free state, you could be hauled back into bondage. Frederick Douglass escaped and went to England. And so, again, Maryland and Baltimore had the highest percentages of free blacks, and so it always created a lot of dynamic and tension, particularly in the greater Fells Point areas.
So this War of 1812, which is, I know that you're going to be at the Reginald F. Lewis, at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson on the symposium on the War of 1812, and the black participation in that war is something we always forget. I was telling you before we went on the air that I had a conversation with Dr. Annette Palmer, who's chairperson of the graduate faculty in history and geography here at Morgan State University. And she's one of the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The families that were enslaved in the Chesapeake, ran to the British lines, fought with the British, and ended up creating these communities in the West Indies in Trinidad. And I you coming on the air today made me think of that conversation we had and the complexity of the world of black folks during that time of the War of 1812.
Yes, it was a lot of contention, and I would say it was really a contested space. I mean, every inch of it was fought one way or another. And even in Charles Ball's narrative, it talks about how the enslaved people had an option. The British were offering freedom to any enslaved people that made its way to its boats or its forts and encampments and offered the bounty of freedom. One option was Nova Scotia. Another one was Trinidad and other places in the Caribbean. And so even Charles Ball had to make that decision about whether or not he would remain with the Americans. And he joined in Commodore Joshua Barney's Chesapeake Flotilla and ended up fighting against some of the same enslaved people he was on plantations with. And so it's a very fascinating story.
I mean, that I'm just picturing that the split that happens. And because of the enslavement of Africans, this idea that here are two sets of people, both vying for their freedom, one saying, okay, maybe I have it better, I may be free if I fight with the Americans, or they say, no, I'll go with the British, because the British offered freedom if they fought. And just trying to picture, like, friends and family on, like, either side of this divide.
Yes, it was fascinating. But the interesting thing, Mark, this wasn't the first time the British had offered this deal on the Chesapeake.
Right.
If you go back to 1776, the same offer was made when America was initially fighting for its independence. The British came into the Chesapeake region with the same offer. And some took advantage of it and it ended up in a very cold, rocking Nova Scotia. And
right.
So even in Charles Ball's narrative, his grandfather, who was what you call a saltwater Negro, meaning that he was an enslaved person that came directly from Africa versus one who was born on a plantation.
I've never heard that expression before.
Yes. Uh-huh. And so even we talk about that whole juxtaposition of the African experience, that diaspora, the move from the triangle, from Africa to the Caribbean to the Americas, it's really been a tense situation. And so in 1776, that offer was made, and here it was 40 years later in 1812, 1814, the same offer was made again.
Lord Dunsmore.
And those people of color who joined in with the British were known as the Ethiopian troops. They were trained on Tangier Island. It's an island in the Chesapeake,
right,
across the Virginia,
right,
line. And then when we come back again in 1812 and 1814, they were known as the Colonial Marines. Those are the enslaved people who put on the red coat versus the American blue coat. And again, and some played offense and defense.
And why not? I talk a bit about, from all your learning and history and the people you've met around the Chesapeake. A bunch of questions in my head. We're going to do this again today for a longer day, maybe just go out and do a taping together so we can talk and walk and look at these things together. But what is some of the hidden power that we don't see in our history now of black folks on the Chesapeake, Eastern Shore and Western Shore, and how folks really define things, because they're often left out of these history books. Because, you know, Southern Maryland and the Eastern Shore were just like Mississippi, right, and sometimes still are. Worse than Mississippi in some ways.
Well, my title of my book is called The Chesapeake Bay Through Ebony Eyes and Through the Eyes of African Americans. And I spent a lot of time with a gentleman, Earl White. He was a waterman born on the lower eastern shore, Princess Anne's County, Dames Quarter, Deal Island area on Tangier Sound. And Earl was a waterman for over 60 years. In his latter years, he worked with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation as the first mate on their educational skipjack boat called the Stanley Norman. And one night, the boat was docked in City Dock in Annapolis, and Earl invited me down below deck. And he said, Vince, let me tell you about the other Chesapeake. And I said, Earl, what do you mean by the other Chesapeake? He said, Vince, the Chesapeake that you never see about, you never hear about. He talked about how what people just talk about sunrises and sunsets and, oh, how beautiful the bay is. But he said that the bay is a place of hope and a place of despair. And he began to recount the stories about how storms came from nowhere and how men and women lost their lives on the Chesapeake Bay in storms. And so, again, he just talked about how people romanticize the beautiful sunrises and sunsets. But there's a other Chesapeake. And so for about 20 years, I just visited all the towns Earl visited. He introduced me to people. He carried me onto the black side of the Chesapeake Bay.
And what do we learn from that? I mean, what is something that we need to begin to learn about that black side of the Chesapeake Bay that we don't know, that about how it formed who we are?
What I would really say is that from the earliest time, whether it's Jamestown, Virginia in 1619 is when you first had people of color coming onto the Chesapeake in terms of modern history. But African Americans have always been a part of the Bay, free and black. They've been boat builders and sailmakers and owners of seafood processing plants. They've been navigators and pilots. And when I use the term pilots, I'm not talking about airplanes. I'm talking about navigating the shoals, the sandbars, the waterways, the creeks that meander through the Chesapeake Bay. African Americans have served as guides in military pursuits and moving commerce along the Chesapeake Bay. And so what I would say, Mark, and your listening audience, that African Americans have been involved, intricately involved, significantly involved in all aspects of Maryland and the Chesapeake Bay region's maritime and seafood industry. And through our books, writing, curriculum, documentary films, we've been unearthing that story.
So you have this lovely story in here that I was reading earlier, In Heaven with Daddy, Memories of a Waterman's Daughter by Melanie Redding.
Yes, I
think these kind of pieces are important because again, when you look at pictures of watermen, all you see is white watermen.
Yes, and Melanie Redding, she's Melanie Herrera. She is now the president of the Blacks of the Chesapeake Foundation. I was her mentor. Mm-hmm. She was a student at Anne Arundel Community College when I'd worked there. She caught the spirit of the Chesapeake. She's a prolific writer. Her background is in Masters of Social Work and Health Administration, so she really looks at a lot of environmental justice kind of issues. And those are things that Blacks of the Chesapeake are looking at now, health and health equity. But traditionally, our work has been around watermen and the women and the sisters and the moms and the grandparents. And so this one story Melanie wrote, Memories of a Waterman's Daughter, just talked about how the watermen worked on the Chesapeake Bay on the months that had auras in it, the cold months, the Septembers, Decembers, the Januarys, right, the Februarys. And then from June to September, they would go to the Delaware Bay and actually work there with major industries who were planting shellfish, because in Delaware, you can actually own the river bottoms, and companies had syndicates that had boats with 30 and 40 and sometimes 50 men on it, versus traditional Chesapeake Bay watermen. If you were on an oyster harvesting boat, you may have 6 to 8 people, but most of the time it was one or two guys on a small skiff with a set of hand tongs and a lot of heart. And so again, you could not only earn a living, but you could provide sustenance to your family. And so the bay was a gateway to freedom.
So, pardon me, I'm sorry, Vince, and everybody else. But you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Maybe you have your own stories of your family in the Chesapeake that you want to share here. And I said, what's going to be the centerpiece of what you're going to talk about this weekend?
At the symposium on the War of 1812, they are bringing together writers and historians from all around the country. I was recently featured on a PBS nationally broadcast program called War of 1812, where we actually looked at the roles that African Americans played in the war on the British side and the American side. So I'll be talking about the contributions that African Americans made in the War of 1812. So often you hear about Maurice Pickersgill or Betsy Ross with the flag. We all know the story of Francis Scott Key and his poem that became the Star Spangled Banner, but few people know about the roles and contributions of African Americans right here in Baltimore. So I'll be lifting up those stories. Charles Ball, William Roberts, Caesar Wentworth, these are people that are chronicled.
And the young woman, I'm blocking on her name because we learned about her when we did the piece on the Flag House, who actually did most of the work on the flag.
Yes, right there at the Flag House, there was a, quote, servant, right. But I think she was a slave, an enslaved person, and again, who had a hand on the Stars and the Stripes, on the wool and the cotton. And again, it's lifting up those various stories.
And we also always forget that when we sing that song, the Star Spangled Banner, I all should remember that Francis Scott Key was a lawyer, was the Attorney General of Washington, D.C., and was pro-slave and owned slaves and owned enslaved people. I mean, it's this very complex world we're talking about, the 1812.
Very complex, and even I've been at conferences where individuals have kind of teased out the poem, Star Spangled Banner, and the words, and when it just talks about the absconding of property and returning property to people of to slave owners. And so again, as one teases apart that rich story, again, it's the African-American experience that we're lifting up, even as we talk about what do the words mean in our Star-Spangled Banner and the home of the free and the land of the brave. And again, it's another story to be told.
No, it is, and I think that this and it's an important piece of our history. I mean, and that I think that, you know, as we take hold and as Americans and kind of take hold of our history and not just have the whitewashed history we've always grown up with. This is why this is so important, to kind of understand the wholeness of who we are, and what has been left out all this time of our history.
Yes, and I think right here at Morgan State University. I work with colleges and universities all around the country, really, and looking at the rich resources we have around the Morgan Mile and the things that the new president is trying to do, Dr. Wilson, again, just trying to find ways to tie this body of history to the story, the Morgan story, the Baltimore story, and again, be a centerpiece or epicenter of our history and culture.
Before we run out of time, you mentioned a couple of names. I just want to go have you describe them just briefly. George Roberts and William Williams.
Well, again, when people hear about the pride of Baltimore, there was a George Roberts who worked on a cannon right on what they called the Chaucer or the Pride of Baltimore. So we'll talk about his role and, again, how the pride was used for breaking the transatlantic slave trade and intercepting, and there were African Americans on the Pride of Baltimore. This Commodore Joshua Bonney, who was a War of Independence naval hero who actually ran interference and disrupted the British lines, and there was Charles Ball and Caesar Wentworth and those that was with Commodore Bonney at the Battle of Benedict, the Battle of Bladensburg, when the British beat both of those, turned, racked, ransacked, and burned the nation's capital. Again, African Americans were all along there. And so when people talk about the Star-Spangled Banner Trail, let's talk about the trail that African Americans had all along the way. And that's what we're dedicated to, lifting up and telling those stories.
Well, Vince Leggett, this has really been a pleasure and honor to meet you and have you in our studio. And by the way, the young woman whose name actually did most of the work on the American flag we were talking about was Grace Wisher, who was 13 years old.
Yes.
Who lived in that flag house.
Yes.
And so I just wanted to remember that out here. So Vince Leggett, who's a historian, founder of Blacks of the Chesapeake, his book, The Chesapeake Bay Through Ebony Eyes, which I now have a copy of and I'm happy to have it. Vince Leggett will be speaking at the Creative Alliance at the 1814, the Summation, a History Symposium on the War of 1812. That's this Saturday at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson. It's an all-day event. More information can be found at creativealliance.org. And what time is your panel?
My panel will be at 1 o'clock.
At one, in the afternoon?
Yes.
Obviously not in the morning. 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So go to creativealliance.org. And unless you want to have something at the midnight hour. Meet Vince Leckett and hear more about this. Vince, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Well, you're a national icon, and it's great to be in your presence, sir.
Thank you. Good to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks.
Won't be the last time. Thank you. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going out of here with all cast joining in. Buck Clayton, the jazz trumpeter, band leader, composer, arranger, was born Wilbur Dorsey Clayton on this day in Parsons, Kansas in 1911. He was a leading member of Count Basie's Old Testament Orchestra and went on to record and lead his own session recordings in the 50s. And Louis Armstrong was a dear friend and influenced his work a lot, and he passed away in December of 1991. So remember him on this day with his music. We'll be right back. Don't go away. As you wrestle with what just happened at Lincoln University and the speech the president of Lincoln University gave to the women of that university, caused a great deal of controversy. And look in our own backyard. Here's Johns Hopkins that has his own issues with sexual abuse. Stay with us. We'll be right back.